Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Trent Kling alongside Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show in our interview segment, we'll talk to Justine Santa Cruz. She's the VP of Product at Satisfy Labs, and Wendy Albert, the Senior Director of Marketing for the Miracle Mile Shops, about their collaboration to bring AI to a Vegas shopping center. We'll also be discussing the Container Store unveiling a new store format, Bed Bath & Beyond released earnings this week, and Amazon buys their way into the pharmacy sector, and we'll talk about why it may not be the end of the world for retail pharmacy, as some analysts seem to be indicating. A reminder to follow us, rate us if you listen, and make sure and follow us on Twitter as well, at Retail Podcast, and on Instagram, at Retail Podcast there as well. We lead off today's show with Party City. They didn't release earnings this week, but instead they released big news, or what we saw as significant news, in the toy space as they make a move into toys, a natural progression from their current product mix, only they're doing so on a seasonal basis. Now, Party City, whom we've discussed several times on the podcast, is no stranger to the seasonal space. If you're familiar with their concept, they have what are called Halloween City stores that usually show up in September. The company calls these pop-up stores. Not only do they have 900 company-owned and franchised Party City stores in the U.S., but they're also one of the largest distributors and manufacturers of party goods in the U.S. as well. Very vertically integrated, the company has long been steadfast in this model. It's allowed them to expand quickly internationally as well, and their focus on growth now just beyond their own retail stores. They distribute to a whopping 40,000 retail outlets worldwide, but here they see white space in an area that they feel like they can move into to capitalize on seasonal sales.
Here they look to seize on an opportunity presented by the absence of Toys R Us and build out their own seasonal presence with a banner named Toy City, play on Party City. Toys R Us, before their initial store closings, before the official bankruptcy, had over 900 stores throughout the United States. As we look at the format of this rollout with Toy City, this rollout will be limited to 50 locations nationwide, a slightly lower number than their previous, and also seasonal, Halloween City rollouts. They typically do 300 or so of those each year, and in that particular case, some of those stores are actually used as test locations for potential future Party City stores, which works for both the property owners and Party City. The landlord, in that case, gets short-term cash flow and a potential future tenant, while Party City gets to test a market without actually having a long-term commitment in place. However, these Toy City stores will have something in common with Halloween City. They'll share the same space. Halloween City locations often do what other seasonal Halloween stores do. They lease, presumably at a cheap rate, vacant real estate in major shopping centers. One example is San Luis Obispo, a Halloween City opened up in a former Borders location. Toy City will open in September in these 50 locations alongside Halloween City. And unlike Halloween City, Toy City stores will actually remain open well into December and through Christmas. Obviously, all of those last-minute shoppers trying to get those toy sales out of the way. The checkouts and inventory system will be fully integrated with Halloween City. Basically, after Halloween, it appears as though the stores will shift from being hybridized into being 100% Toy City locations. What is interesting is that Party City is seizing on popular lingo to grab headlines. The term pop-up has been popularized, and we've talked about it on this podcast, by high-end retailers and e-commerce pure plays, but it is not a term we've often given to seasonal shops such as this in the past. James M. Harrison, their CEO, mentioned that the need for a natural brand extension to capitalize on the fresh white space in the toy segment is obvious. Toys R Us is leaving behind close to $11 billion in annualized toy sales. That is a lot of market share left behind by Toys R Us. In addition to brick-and-mortar locations, Party City will endeavor to include more toys on their e-commerce site, ranging even beyond the holiday shopping season. They were clear that e-commerce extension is a test to see if e-commerce top-line revenues do in fact see a bump from having more products online. They already have over 30% more SKUs online than their average store, so this is not new for Party City to offer something in an online-only capacity. And as we shift to the operations front, you have to question how they're going to fill these stores with the merchandise, and we look at the production and sourcing questions surrounding this Toy City pop-up, if you will. As we mentioned at the top of the story, Party City has been clear on attempting to source as many of their retail products currently in Party City stores from within as possible.
The result of this has been a number of buyouts of their vendors so as to better control the process from start to finish. Essentially, if they do a lot of work with a particular company, then they seek potential options to vertically integrate that company into their model. And as of this month, in fact, at the William Blair conference that took place earlier in June, they cited that 80% of what they sell through their retail business is sourced or manufactured through their own wholesale business. They manufacture or source over 50,000 SKUs through their wholesale division, all told. However, I think the question with this toy rollout is how many toys can they manufacture from within? Can they reach that 80% mark? And more importantly, will any toys they manufacture from within be as popular as some of the licensed toys we see from the likes of Hasbro or Mattel? Well, at that same William Blair conference, they bragged about how their 200-plus person design team at Party City allows for the introduction of 8,000 new products every single year. That's about 20% of their overall SKUs, give or take. It stands to reason, then, that this design team has probably been working on this Toy City development at least since the Toys R Us bankruptcy issues cropped up late last year, just in case they could hop on this and create this Toy City format. And another thing also that Party City has long trumpeted, in fact, is their ability to pivot at a moment's notice based on consumer feedback. So if they've been doing it for party supplies, one would reason that they could do it going from party supplies to toys. Their average lead time from concept to delivery is around 10 months. So it is conceivable when you work everything out, they could get internal developments into their Toy City stores on time and perhaps more developments internally towards November and December when the toy shopping season picks up. So again, we expect that a decent number of toys may be internally sourced, probably not that 80% number, but at least 20 to 30%. And when we speak about that licensure issue, one thing that's interesting is when you break down their wholesale model, Party City actually has existing licenses with Marvel, Warner Brothers, Disney, and Nickelodeon. Disney in particular is a partnership that they've continually boasted about having. Their wholesale division also has a strong relationship with Mattel, actually sourcing products from Mattel and then wholesaling them out to retailers. So we can expect that sourcing there may be a little bit easier because of this. They're not having to forge a new relationship. And they mentioned that 5% of their direct-to-retail wholesale licenses that exist already are actually with specialty suppliers like Mattel. We can, of course, expect this number to go up with that Toy City extension. Now, let's talk about that real estate, which is one of the reasons why they're able to do Halloween City or Toy City in the first place, is that you've got available large format real estate in various areas in the U.S. One of the reasons Party City may be able to execute on their new strategy is a current glut of decent-sized anchor positions in strip malls, particularly after the exit of Toys R Us themselves.
It is likely that they will choose a larger square foot location to jump in with the combination of Toy City and Halloween City, with smaller, say 8,000 to 20,000 square foot locations reserved for Halloween City exclusively. This would create a decent marketing opportunity for them if you think about it, as potential customers would recognize a former Toys R Us as a place to get toys, certainly. So if a Toys City ends up moving into a store that was a longtime Toys R Us location, it is going to be convenient for the customer with a fairly quick turnaround this year. Trent, I remember you telling me a shopping center you visited last week had both a Party City and a closing Toys R Us. So this actually would be another wrinkle here, and that Party City could end up moving a Toy City in to operations that they currently already have. So distribution would be a little bit easier. A center like this would provide an optimal opportunity for Party City, as they have a pre-existing relationship also with the property owner, Kimco, in that particular case that you were telling me about. A number of Kmart and Sears stores have also closed recently, and there are a few more instances of abandoned real estate still around from the Sports Authority closures. I actually live by one that has remained vacant for this entire time since that bankruptcy. However, we should know that occupancy rates are generally going up around the country, or at least staying fairly tight, particularly in A and B class shopping centers. Party cities are generally in the latter, however. As we mentioned on our Twitter account, businesses like Ollie's Bargain Outlet are aggressively seeking their own property purchases for those stores that are left behind by Toys R Us and other retailers, making mid-Atlantic real estate difficult to come by in certain spots. In the end, we feel as though this is a natural extension, like we said at the beginning of the story, for Party City's core business. If they can begin to adequately scale production on their wholesale side, we may see an expansion of the concept next year, perhaps up to 100 stores. As it is, Party City is just another entrant into the toy space, attempting to capture Toys R Us market share that was left behind. Others we've mentioned include JCPenney, Target, Walmart, and of course Five Below, as we've talked about here recently, with their trend-catching ways. If all goes well, maybe a few Toy City locations will be more permanent, existing beyond a seasonal designation.
Well, from a company trying out a new concept entirely to a company that's trying slowly to reinvent themselves, Bed Bath & Beyond reports earnings with a slight surprise on the bottom line earnings, but falling same-store sales. After the earnings announcement, Bed Bath & Beyond stock shot down from $20.18 per share to $18.27 per share early Thursday. They actually rebounded back to $20.18 before trading concluded on Friday for the week. We should note that as we begin this story, we're both fairly bearish on Bed Bath & Beyond, something that you'll be able to tell as we go through. And honestly, this earnings call added to the bearishness. The market also bearish on Bed Bath & Beyond. A price-to-earnings ratio of just 6.6 suggests that the market doesn't see a lot of growth going forward and maybe even a compression in their earnings ability, something the company themselves admit we might see over the next year. As a refresher, Bed Bath & Beyond operates stores not only under that particular name, but also Cost Plus, World Market, Christmas Tree Shops, which is another seasonal offering, much like Halloween City we just discussed, and that Harmon Face Values Bye Bye Baby, which they spent a lot of time on the earnings call discussing. They also run several e-commerce websites, not only e-commerce websites attached to those stores I just discussed, but also ofakind.com, onekingslane.com, personalizationmall.com, chefcentral.com, decorist.com, harborlinen.com, and tygroup.com. I'm out of breath, and honestly, we've suggested a lack of focus may be hurting their overall efforts in the past. You might be able to see what we mean, given all of those brands. So we use that as a framework to now jump into earnings. If it's not a growth story for the company, then what is it exactly? Well, largely it's a story of stagnation rather than out and out flagging sales. Some sales declining in some areas of their company, some sales are accelerating. Zach's consensus estimates had Bed Bath & Beyond coming in with net earnings of 31 cents per share. They delivered with actually 32 cents per share in non-GAAP numbers. This is a decline, however, from last year with earnings of 53 cents per share for 2017's first quarter. And it looks even worse when you go back 2 years, when you compare it to 2016, 80 cents per share in the first quarter there, 32 cents per share in this particular quarter. So earnings are going down despite the fact that they beat analyst estimates. Despite that, they had some positive indicators.
Net sales were slightly up to $2.8 billion, an increase of just 0.4% over last year's first quarter. Again, that's comprised of decreasing and increasing sales throughout a number of categories and throughout a number of banners, given their vast ability to try to leverage their online platforms. Part of the increase was due to a small increase in the number of stores that they operate, 11 more total since last year. They actually lost a store count in their staple Bed Bath & Beyond banner, but gained stores in their World Market Cost Plus division. Despite a marginal top-line increase, same-store sales declined 0.6%. However, if you dig into those numbers, their same-store sales include digital sales from those banners, which the company indicated increased by a double-digit percentage. So if online sales increased by a double-digit percentage and they're included in the same-store sales metric, that only means one thing. The actual physical sales decreased rapidly this quarter. They noted that their physical stores, which have certainly been flagging as of late, saw mid-single-digit percentage declines. So if earnings were down year over year, but revenue was up, that means that costs were up, which means that margins are in fact eroding for Bed Bath & Beyond. Cost of goods sold as a percentage of sales went up from 63.5% last year to 65% this year. Also, selling, general, and administrative expenses were up as a percentage of sales. Not good for the company, given what they've been talking about over the last 4 to 5 quarters, from 31.1% of sales here to 32.1% of sales for this particular quarter. So, after interest expense and income tax provisions, their net margin was a paltry 1.6% of sales, down from 2.7% last year. Even 2.7% would be not a so healthy number for the retailer, but to see a decline in this way is disappointing to those who bought into store management changes last year. Again, they've been talking about making a turnaround, especially with trying to mitigate selling, general, and administrative expenses and to source a little bit better products. They talk about their supply chain ad nauseum. Mature grocers even have better margins than Bed Bath & Beyond. To put this in perspective, around 3% or high 2% for mature grocers, which shows that either the changes for Bed Bath & Beyond aren't working outright or they are just taking longer to stick. As a refresher, they announced a store management realignment acceleration in August of last year. In the release trumpeting the changes, Stephen Tamaras, their CEO, basically put forth every single buzzword in the retail universe. All of those words that we hear and read about in retail media. He mentioned omnichannel, customer focus, IT, analytics, marketing, supply chain, evolution, and of course, customer trust. So all of those buzzwords really don't amount to much if you don't execute at a high level. I don't know about you, but I just got a bingo for my retail buzzword bingo card. Anyhow, this realignment resulted in a reduction of about 880 manager positions within their Bed Bath & Beyond segment and Bye Bye Baby stores. Yet, selling, general, administrative expenses, like I just said, was still up, both as a raw number and as a percentage of sales, despite the supposed savings of around $60 million through this transition. The managers that stayed on board were given some stock incentives, so that was a factor that wasn't clearly relayed to the analysts or investors when they first rolled out these different restructuring plans. So it ends up being a wash, and you have over 800 managers without a job. So probably going to be a net negative for the company and society as a whole. The company, Trent, is really at a point in time where they have to realize where they're at and try to make the necessary adjustments to be positive for the rest of this year, at least.
And those savings you mentioned of $16 million, they didn't really come to fruition, at least in terms of helping things out. And the company said, looking forward, they expect margins to continue to be shaved off. And all of those buzzwords that Tamaras had from last year, conspicuously gone from this quarter's earnings release. In fact, the earnings release that was sent out to news media, no quote from management was given whatsoever, which if you look at earnings releases, that's actually very rare. Management couldn't hide from the analyst Q&A on the earnings call, however. Tamaras said during the call that this quarter largely achieved their goals of pushing same-store sales towards a positive number, which is technically true. Same-store sales were down 2.0% in 2017's first quarter. We see under 1% they declined in this quarter. And they said they achieved goals of moderating declines in operating profit. Well, technically, on a number standpoint or a raw number standpoint, that's correct. But in terms of a rate or a percentage standpoint, declines seem to be at approximately the same rate as they were last year. Now, as businesses are known to do on earnings calls, they quickly pivoted towards areas of strength and away from their areas of weakness on the call. And for them, it was decorative furnishings. Debbie Propst, the chief merchandising officer of One Kings Lane, mentioned that sales of decorative furnishings were up 21.5% within Bed Bath & Beyond and Bye Bye Baby over this last year. In case you're wondering what this category includes, that would be furniture, lighting, rugs, art, mirrors, and wall decor, according to the company. Engagement with those categories on the Bed Bath & Beyond website, they mentioned, is up 34%. However, it's not parlaying itself into conversion, as the average order value in this category was up just 4.4%, meaning that they're not seeing the conversion rise along with the engagement numbers that they're seeing on the website. Now, after spending what seemed like forever, and to me it seemed like 20 minutes, it probably wasn't that long, but it seemed like forever talking about these decorative furnishings, they've talked about real estate. And Leighton, this is something I found interesting. They mentioned the flexibility of their real estate contracts, as they have nearly a quarter of their leases coming due in the next 2 years across all of their brick and mortar stores. and an average remaining lease term of 4.2 years overall, which is fairly low for a retailer of this size. Now, one of the things that they did was they mentioned the flexibility that this brings with it in rolling out what they call their next generation stores. Now, these stores, and there's only a handful of them so far, produce about 10 to 15% more transactions than the original stores. However, impact on overall revenue is negligible. These stores play up value propositions towards the front of the stores. So you look at their real estate situation, and honestly, we have a bit of a different take. Lease rates are increasing in prime areas, many of which Bed Bath & Beyond have locations in. And there are a number of businesses, Five Below being one, that are rapidly expanding, and they're looking for locations with the same approximate footprint of a Bed Bath & Beyond store. Basically, we see it as though Bed Bath & Beyond doesn't have as much leverage as they might have had 2 years ago if the same circumstance came to roost then. And we can actually see a future where instead of this flexibility that they're playing up, their lease rates actually go up rather than being locked into a long-term lease where they know what their lease rates are going to be going forward. I think there's a lot of uncertainty here, and you see a future where potentially these lease rates could go up because Bed Bath & Beyond doesn't have the leverage that they're looking for with these landlords. And Tamara's, in fact, on the call mentioned attempting even to negotiate for capital improvements with landlords to facilitate these new format stores. If these stores were in indoor malls or C-class shopping centers, certainly we would give them credit for more leverage. But despite what you may hear about the brick-and-mortar climate, when you look at it under a microscope, shopping center owners may in fact currently hold the upper hand in negotiations, especially if Bed Bath & Beyond wants to lowball on term or rate. Bed Bath & Beyond on the call mentioned that they are bringing a customer that is very valuable to these shopping centers, but we actually kind of have started to see it the other way around as traffic has decreased in the brick and mortar stores. And as Bed Bath & Beyond has struggled to really get the omni-channel functionality between website and brick and mortar working, I think in many cases, these shopping centers are more of a benefit to Bed Bath & Beyond than the other way around. Management also on the call, I felt like, gave a messy answer to Mike Baker of Deutsche Bank, who asked some very good questions about their couponing. Baker asked if couponing was up or down in terms of an impact on margins quarter over quarter last year. And they said effectively that fewer coupons had been redeemed, in part because of their new Beyond Plus program, which just gets counted during a transaction as one big coupon. But actually, there were increased dollars on coupons. However, they had no idea whether the impact on the bottom line was lower or higher than previous years. And it's always unsettling when a business can't tell you specifics, not because they don't want to, but just because they don't have those numbers in terms of something that is so big to their business model as couponing is to Bed Bath & Beyond. And Leighton, I know you were looking at one other thing they mentioned during the earnings call.
Yeah. More meaningfully, they mentioned a shift in merchandise mix at Bye Bye Baby to attempt to capture Babies R Us customers. To this point, they've had some impact from Babies R Us customers coming into their stores, but the impact has been very small. They hope to make the needle move more as the year goes on. In the end, not a good quarter for the company and not a clear path forward out of stagnation. Perhaps the main positive was an increase in cash and cash equivalents on hand at the end of the quarter, up nearly 50% from last year's quarter to nearly $679 million. Still, they have to produce something with that cash. Everyone always talks about reinvestment. Their reinvestment strategy has not been working. So having cash on the balance sheet really doesn't mean anything if you can't execute a positive strategy. So still, they haven't fixed the merchandising issues in the stores, and the realignment hasn't resulted in any appreciable change in store. Worse, their in-store sales keep declining at the cost of their digital sales, which seem to be coming with increased overhead. So heavy discounting and free shipping offers at most of their digital channels are chipping away at margins. Additionally, they mentioned on the Q&A that deleveraging and gross margin is likely to continue for the rest of this year. If you are a shareholder, at least they have a healthy dividend of 3.2%. So again, another last positive takeaway here, but really not much else to like about the current direction of the company.
Well, coming up after the music, we'll be joined by our interview guest, Justine Santa Cruz, a VP of Product at Satisfy Labs, and Wendy Albert, the Senior Director of Marketing for the Miracle Mile Shops in Las Vegas, talking about their new collaboration. Last year, we discussed in this very space a partnership between Satisfy Labs and Mall of America in Minnesota to launch an AI system designed to make the mall experience friction-free for a visitor. Satisfy has taken their talents now to Las Vegas, specifically the Miracle Mile Shops. Just this month, the Miracle Mile Shops and Satisfy rolled out Jules, an AI bot for Facebook Messenger. And here to talk with us about the partnership are Justine Santa Cruz, the VP of Product at Satisfy Labs, and Wendy Albert, the Senior Director of Marketing for the Miracle Mile Shops. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Trent.
All right, so first to kind of lay the foundation for our listeners here, Wendy, I was wondering if you could describe the Miracle Mile Shops for us. How does the Miracle Mile differ from your run-of-the-mill shopping center?
Well, first of all, we're in Las Vegas, so I think that changes everything right off the bat. But Miracle Mile Shops is located right in the middle of Las Vegas Boulevard. We have 200 stores and restaurants, and we have two live theaters that have 15 different shows going every single day. So that makes the shopping center a little bit different. But then on top of that, we are unusual in the amount of traffic and sales that come through the shopping center. We have 72,000 visitors to the shopping center every day. We hit 26 million last year in 2017. So we just have so much going on all the time. And then we also have, on top of our theaters that are here in the shopping center, we're attached to Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino, which is unusual for shopping centers. They have the theater that houses the residencies for Gwen Stefani that starts on Wednesday, which we're very excited about, Jennifer Lopez, Backstreet Boys, and Pitbull.
So a lot going on there. As you mentioned, a lot of visitors in person, which no doubt means a lot of visitors to your social media, and that's where kind of this partnership comes in. I'm wondering just where did this partnership come about? How did this partnership get initiated?
Well, we started because we really are always looking for new ways to engage with our customers. And because there's so much noise in Las Vegas in terms of just all the excitement and all of the activity that's happening here, we're always looking for new ways to, you know, engage with our customers. And we're always looking to technology to make the shopping experience better for everybody. So we started looking at that, and then we decided that we wanted to get a chatbot and did some research and found Satisfy, and really just thought that they would best fit our needs based on their experience and what they've done with other retail entities.
So Justine, we'll turn to you now. How did you go about implementing this AI on behalf of the Miracle Mile Shops?
Yeah, so as we did with our other clients, both entertainment and retail clients, we approached it with a basic kind of human understanding of what the property is. Wendy does an amazing job of really portraying their property as something very special, very unique, and has a very unique clientele that comes in and out of that venue or location. So, you know, just starting with a conversation, I think a lot of people think AI is quite complex to get off the ground. But the first step is really just talking about what are the use cases, what are the customer questions that we are fielding today that maybe human staff is dealing with, or maybe things that we want to get to know about our customers. So having that conversation with Wendy and her team and kind of coming up with also our suggestions on similar venues that we've worked with and what has come up in the past. So kind of pulling that all together, we come up with a scope and execute from there.
Now, I'm kind of curious because part of the biggest thing about this rollout is here the personality of the bot. You know, you get a lot of AI bots that are pretty much just standard question and answer type things. And it's very clear that this bot will be just as unique as Vegas is. I think anyone that watched the recent Stanley Cup Finals saw just how different Vegas can be from a lot of different cities that are out there. I'm wondering, between the two of you, how did you guys kind of hone in on this personality that you've created for Jules such that it shines through in the interface?
We really wanted to make sure that Jules was a fun embodiment, an accurate portrayal of our brand. Miracle Mile Shops is really, we've established it as kind of the fun, cool, hip shopping center on the Strip. So we wanted to make sure that Jules represented that feeling. And we wanted to make sure that when our customers are having, you know, a conversation, that they weren't just having it with a generic customer service representative. So we created Jules. And a matter of fact, Justine and the Satisfy team and all of us around her, we talk about her like she's a real person. So we really want to make sure that all of her responses are sassy and witty and just like she is.
Yeah, and I think if anything to add to that, I mean, the character and the personality of Jules is 100% the credit goes to the Miracle Mile shops. They have crafted that from nothing and really explained it to us at Satisfy really well how they want her embodied. I think the one thing that we just add to the table is enhancing that with adding images and making sure that we let the Miracle Mile shops team know when certain questions or kind of error message come up so that even if she doesn't know something, it's still a cute answer. So I think having that collaboration is really important when we work with partners like them.
You touched on a couple of things that I wanted to talk about here. You know, if you go to the Miracle Mile Shops homepage, miraclemileshopslv.com, Jules is featured prominently on the homepage. And it's not just that, hey, we've got an AI bot or hey, that we have a messenger, but there's an actual image there. There's a picture of what ideally Jules would look like. And that comes up as well. I was playing with the Facebook Messenger version of it, and that comes up based on different answers that she gives. So where did you guys come up with the ideal image for Jules? How did that process work in crafting this image for an AI bot that we usually think of as just, you know, maybe a static file footage type picture?
When we were creating Jules, we wanted to make sure that she was approachable and fun and represented who our customer is and represented what people envision themselves to be when they're in Las Vegas, because I think the great thing about Vegas is that you get to be somebody else for a few days. So we thought that Jules really does that. You know, she's wearing, obviously, sequins, which is, you know, you must wear sequins while you're in Vegas at some point. We just wanted to make sure that she looked approachable and looked like somebody you would want to hang out with and have fun with and go shopping with. That's how we came to how she looks.
And you talk about some of the responses as well, as Justine mentioned, you know, even if she doesn't know the answer, there's a response out there. And I tried for a little while to stump Jules just on Facebook to see what those messages were like before coming on here. And one such message was like, I don't understand what you're asking. I feel like I'm back in high school math with, you know, some sort of an emoji there. How did you guys craft those responses as well so that you can still retain that audience, even if maybe you can't give the audience the answer they're looking for?
I think what we did is we worked really closely with Satisfy, who obviously, because of their experience, knows the type of questions that we need to be prepared to answer. And then we also worked with everybody on our team here at the shopping center to come up with what are the 300, which sounds like a lot, but really we could probably come up with 10,000 responses for Jules and what she would be asked and what she would, how she would answer it. So we all worked really closely together to make sure that we had the right responses for her.
And Justine, I'm kind of wondering what the learning curve was like for Satisfy jumping into a very unique circumstance, because I know Satisfy serves entertainment venues, you serve retail venues here, you have kind of an all-in-one, and not only that, you're crafting it with this personality.
Yeah, it was fun. It wasn't as bad as we thought. I think what surprised us the most is that, I don't know, Trent, if we talked about it last year, but Satisfy is big in sports and live venues that I think we spoke about a lot of entertainment clients the last time, but sports is actually a big vertical for us. And as Wendy mentioned, there are a lot of shows and activities and things to do around the Miracle Mile, not just shopping. So I think we were actually able to leverage our expertise in other types of venues and other types of live shows so that we could, you know, shorten that learning curve.
I'm also curious, now that the bot is up, it's running, where you'd like to go from here, not only with the partnership overall, but just areas in which you feel like you can tweak or maybe improve the bot's presence.
I think what we've been hoping to do next, and we've talked to Satisfy about this already, is that we want to make sure that we're really responding to everything that our customers are asking. So the great thing about Jules is that she's learning as she's going. But then the next steps that we see is that maybe she can help customers book reservations at our restaurants or buy show tickets. We really think that we can make it a one-stop shop for your full experience here at Miracle Mile Shops.
And then also, too, we've talked about the fact that, you know, if Jules doesn't know the answer to a question, you've got a response there for it at least. But is that something also from Satisfy's perspective that you're cataloging and working to build in more answers, not only through AI, but even through human intervention as you go through?
Exactly. And that is really where our AI stands apart, is when we deploy a bought experience like Jewels. It's not about the launch. Of course, it's great, it's pressworthy and gets a lot of attention, but what really sets us apart is the maintenance and how it grows over time. Wendy touched on it actually, that it does learn. So all those I don't knows and all the stumps and, you know, users like you are the users that we look for, because the more times people try to stump Jewels, the more we actually try to learn new things and see if other people are asking the same thing. And maybe that's something we should add to the knowledge base.
Well, to your guys' credit, it took me a good amount of time. It took me several questions to stump Jewels. So I guess that's a positive thing. As you work forward in this partnership, as we mentioned, talking about, you know, maybe refining the approach, maybe adding reservations, are there plans to maybe expand Jewels into other areas so far? I don't want you to give away, of course, any company secrets, but is there a way in which maybe you can play off of Jewels for, you know, branding or marketing purposes such that, you know, when you go to the Miracle Mile, Jewels is your go-to?
Yes, we actually have already started that. When we launched Jewels, we also launched a customer service brand ambassador program on property. So we have ambassadors that are working on the property that can also answer questions and can point people in the direction of Jewels. So if they answer a question in one spot of the shopping center, they can say, if you have more questions while you're touring the center, please log on to Jewels and she'll be able to answer any questions you have as well. So we kind of feel like that Jewels and this brand ambassadors, they work really closely hand in hand together. And then we also have been really focusing on making sure Jewels is everywhere. So she's on all of our advertising. We have her on digital billboards. We have her on print advertising and all of our social media. And then she's all throughout the shopping center. So we already have her. She's a face of Miracle Mile Shops. Absolutely.
It's a really unique partnership. And once again, for those listeners out there that are interested or want to interact with Jewels as well, you can go to MiracleMileShopsLV.com. And again, can't miss it. Links right there on the front page. Justine Santa Cruz, VP of Product at Satisfy Labs, and Wendy Albert, Senior Director of Marketing for the Miracle Mile Shops. Thanks so much for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast today.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Amazon was back in the news this week, and back in the news in a big way. Amazon is purchasing a venture-backed prescription delivery company, sparking new concern over their entry into the retail pharmacy sector. Their entry into retail pharmacy has long been rumored, and their proposed purchase of startup PillPack confirms what many were already assuming about the company. Amazon, up until mid-2017, was reportedly having annual meetings to discuss whether or not they should get into the pharmacy space. They also hired Mark Lyons around March of last year from Premera Blue Cross. One source said that Lyons was only going to be tasked with building an internal pharmacy benefits manager for Amazon employees, but that he may have had a broader consulting assignment for the company. One would stand to reason that a high-level executive in the pharmacy space would probably have some input as to whether or not they should have an entrance into the retail pharmacy space. We take a look at PillPack and what they've been doing. PillPack operates in a similar way to most mail order and online pharmacies. It processes prescriptions and mails them out. Fairly simple, however, pretty complex in the operations of it. They certainly are not the first, however, in this space, nor are they the largest. Other competitors include Express Scripts, United Healthcare's own mail order service, OptumRx, Health Warehouse, CareZone, and so forth. There are plenty out there. PillPack is notable in that, much like CareZone, their competitor there, they sort medications and give customers the option of receiving them in packages geared towards a specific day or a specific time of day. So let's say that a customer has three different medications in the morning. PillPack would ship out packs that have one dose with each of the medications rather than having a separate bottle with several weeks worth of a single medication. Additionally, PillPack includes over-the-counter medications like aspirin or even vitamins in the said packs that they sell. Very interesting, Trent. A lot of reaction on the stock market and big reaction from major retail news outlets.
So let's put this in perspective. PillPack reportedly brought in $100 million in revenue last year. At the same time, they'd raised about $118 million in funding. So again, sale goes through, those venture capitalists and those that funded it will be in for a big payday. To put it in perspective, though, most estimates peg U.S. spending on prescription drugs to be about 800 billion to 1 trillion per year. So we're talking about an infinitesimally small portion of the market. In fact, 0.01% based on last year's numbers that PillPack has introduced. So let's talk about why disruption is likely to be slow in this space. I know I've read a lot of analysts' opinions that say Amazon could compete on price, or Amazon should be worrying CVS or Walgreens Boots Alliance in one way or another because of this deal. But let's look at the other side of it. Let's look at why disruption hasn't really taken place with prescription drugs to this point. Now, even though there are certain efficiencies that Amazon could provide PillPack, and 100% we see where these synergies can come from, the fact remains that this is still medication we're talking about. And it's a highly regulated space. Some have speculated that Amazon may, in fact, attempt to compete on price, but that's difficult to do for a handful of reasons, including the potential refusal of pharmacy benefit managers to work with PillPack or Amazon in the future. That's something we'll discuss in a bit. Also, when you look at price, Amazon really isn't competitive on over-the-counter medication as it is. And I know this firsthand because I take a lot of vitamins, I take a lot of supplements. In no case have I been able to find it cheaper on Amazon than a brick-and-mortar store or a different location. Let me give you one example. Nature Made Super B Complex is about a dollar more expensive on Amazon through Prime Fulfillment than on Walmart.com. And the version on Walmart.com has 100 more pills in it. Same size pills, same everything, except Walmart is obviously the better value. I think it's just a go-to for analysts. They assume that Amazon is going to compete on price, but realistically, Amazon isn't always the cheapest option. And they've shown this in the past with grocery, and I think medication, certainly over-the-counter pills like vitamins, one category in which Amazon really struggles to bring that price to the forefront. So that being said, it's tough to assume they can do the same thing on prescription drugs in the future, especially if they don't get backing of pharmacy benefit managers. Now, part of the barrier, too, to Amazon making any kind of meaningful dent without brick and mortar in the pharmacy space may actually be doctors themselves. If you've ever had a prescription that needs re-upped monthly by a doctor, and these type of things do exist, you might know that sometimes doctors don't send them in until a day or two prior to prescription pickup. Most mail order services, though, take around 2 weeks to fill a script. So if you have a prescription that's not necessarily a renewal for 6 or 7 months, that has to be manually renewed every month by a doctor, they're kind of out of the question, these mail order services are, for those type of medications. PillPack themselves states a 2-week to 1-month lead time before PillPacks can ship out. And if you've got medications that need to be re-upped regularly by a doctor, this can be an issue. Another barrier is actually controlled medications. PillPack, for example, cannot fill Schedule II prescriptions, which largely include things like opioids and codeine as well. And pharmacy benefit managers that I've mentioned several times, they actually control much of the game when it comes to mail order pharmacies. So let's talk a little bit about how this works. Pharmacy benefit managers often either have exclusive rights themselves or have signed exclusive rights with a third party to handle all their mail order medications for patients in that network. Usually, if you get a health insurance plan, that health insurer will assign you some sort of PBM or pharmacy benefit manager. Some examples would be Optum or Caremark. PillPack has fought to work with some insurers, but is still a little bit of a redheaded stepchild when it comes to the robust world of mail order. Much of it is controlled by these pharmacy benefit managers. Express Scripts is one such example of a pharmacy benefit manager that serves as a mail order prescription service. Optum Rx is another. And we should probably mention Caremark, which I just discussed a bit ago. They're a pharmacy benefit manager that's actually owned by CVS, who serves as a mail order and online service both. So in this regard, it's not that Amazon is first to the game. They're just trying to really play catch up with the likes of CVS or Walgreens that has a deal with Express Scripts as an example. Now, you can go outside of your pharmacy benefit manager, but unless that mail order service is a lot cheaper, you're not going to be able to get drugs for a lesser price, typically because those pharmacy benefit managers bake in discounts with certain pharmacies. Finally, mail order services are really only useful for regular medications, and this sounds like it makes obvious sense, but this is something that a lot of analysts we've found have been overlooking. acute and even some chronic illnesses, they require medication that can only be received on a quick turnaround. Let's say you have strep throat. You're unlikely to wait even 2 days for medication to come through via Amazon Prime or something like that, when it could be had same day through a local pharmacy, and a lot of local pharmacies already offer free delivery in town. So there's just not a huge amount of market inefficiency to exploit here as what Amazon's found in other particular areas. Now, there is an argument that there is potentially profit to be had, but the market certainly reacted as though Amazon's going to just about be taking over the world when it comes to retail pharmacy.
We saw a huge reaction on the stock market this week, and we see impacts from CVS, Rite Aid, Walgreens, and Fred's Pharmacy. We tweeted after retail pharmacy stocks saw massive losses Thursday that several of them might see gains Friday or early next week in terms of rebounding after the market corrects from the overreaction. Fred's Pharmacy fell initially 10%, but gained it back and then some on trading on Friday. Some have speculated that Fred's may actually be a target for Amazon as they seek to sell their retail pharmacies and real estate holdings throughout the United States. CVS fell from over $70 a share to around $63 a share, peaked at $66, and closed the week at around $64.35 a share. To us, they are the least likely to take a hit, at least long term, since again, they are well insulated from a pharmacy benefit manager and online scripts service point of view. Carolyn Castell, a CVS spokeswoman, told the New York Times that CVS has the same abilities as PillPack with much larger customer base, and that certainly is the case. They have a massive customer base, especially since taking over the business in those target pharmacies a couple years ago. Walgreens fell from around $66 a share to $59 a share, rebounding then to $60 a share. They reported on Thursday as well, even beating analyst estimates on earnings per share by about 4%. Rite Aid shed 10% from around $2 a share to $1.77 a share, continuing a decline to $1.72 by week's end. Granted, they are also in the midst of the Albertsons takeover, so there are some mitigating factors there with that company. They also released earnings this week on Wednesday and saw a rise in after-hours trading until Amazon's news came out. So the positive news from Rite Aid, it did not matter as soon as Amazon said they were going to be in the retail pharmacy space. We move on to our last story with The Container Store, and they are showing a more modern look that provides digital integration into its stores with a new prototype. Clean and well-lit stores only describe a small part of a larger prototype that has recently been unveiled for the home goods and organization solutions retailer. Lauren Thomas from CNBC had an excellent write-up that discussed the first store of its kind that got unveiled this week in Dallas, Texas. The Container Store has been around since 1978, but has seen much of its growth take place over the last 15 or so years. They sold to private equity firm in 2007 and then had an IPO 7 years later in 2013. Some regard this transformation as one taking place prematurely, since some newer locations would have to undergo major and expensive rework. This does, however, show how proactive management is in the face of new concepts that directly or indirectly compete with their current product offerings. As a publicly traded company, we were able to review their fourth quarter earnings from about 5 weeks ago that showed a healthy company, but one that is growing rather modestly. Total consolidated net sales for the company, which includes third-party sales, were $232.8 million, up 5.3%. Net sales for the Container Store retail business were $214.1 million. Same-store sales for the fourth quarter were 2.7%, which was higher than the average for the entire fiscal 2017, which were actually just under 1%. So again, a company is doing fairly well, but is not showing massive growth in its current store base. They had plenty of positive things, however, to say about their custom closets and nearly all product categories. They are coming off, to my earlier point, 4 net new stores from 2017, which is a sequential deceleration of stores. I believe they had 7 new openings in 2016.
You talk about some of their financials being solid. They've increased gross margins. They've paid proportionately less in SG&A expenses. But at the same time, you mentioned the word proactive, Leighton. I think that really speaks to this resilience to complacency in some of their stores and their showrooms. at the Container Store. It's been an up and down last few years, but it seems as though they've managed to correct course, all the while being listed as one of the best or highest ranked employers in all of retail, a fact that they're very proud about. Now, this particular Dallas store is going to be a real-time ongoing experiment. They're going to see what works and what doesn't. From their press release, they said that their next generation store concept is the result of extensive consumer research conducted in partnership with the Container Store and strategic design and architectural firm FRCH Design Worldwide, as well as digital innovation agency MJD. The company is going to keep opening new locations throughout the U.S., and the most successful elements from this kind of living, breathing experiment will be integrated into those new stores. They currently have over 90 locations, and they hope eventually to transform all of them, but with no rigid time frame, and again, based on what works and what doesn't with this new store format. Some of the store's digital initiatives had actually already been tested, according to the company's CMO. The store will feature 18 digital screens to help customers browse more selections. Color, specs, and product specification design tools will look to engage and inspire what they hope will be a more devoted customer long term. A new organization studio also was started with many proprietary features that allows customers to upload their rooms that need redesigned or organized. Same with what we've talked about with Restoration Hardware attempting to do some of this with some of their showrooms. The in-store organization tool looks to counter the work that Wayfair.com and Amazon have put in to make shopping for furniture and storage items easier to visualize. Wayfair making similar strides to Restoration Hardware in terms of development on 360-degree modeling and that type of thing. One thing that wasn't actually talked about regarding the store was having a larger product assortment. The Container Store is still featuring only about 11,000 products, whereas Wayfair.com and even Bed Bath & Beyond have consistently grown their SKU count, and that's something that Bed Bath & Beyond has talked about even with their new stores, is carrying less in inventory but a larger variety for their customer base. With increased digital optionality, it may behoove the Container Store going forward to extend their highest selling categories to give customers more flexibility, things like product extensions in regards to size and shape in particular. Now, as far as the physical layout of this first prototype store, management looked at every inch to exploit any opportunity to get better. According to their statement, the new architectural design breaks store space into manageable areas that hopefully for them will naturally pull the customer through the store, make it easier to navigate. Ceilings were lowered so as to make the store more inviting. Again, that's their hope. Rows of shelving were removed to improve sight lines across and give a little bit more floor room space. And new flooring was added, as well as enhanced lighting. All of these things were implemented to hope for a more approachable and comfortable environment. We can think of this as a cleaner, smaller IKEA that doesn't force you to go through certain pathways to get through it. The shelving also is much nicer. It's got this wooden casing, like ones you might see at World Market, for example. Wider aisles, giving customers more space to meander, pull out some of their larger storage items, and hopefully interact with those storage items in addition.
We keep mentioning their custom closets initiatives from over the past year of quarterly earnings calls, something they are extremely bullish on because it has that one-on-one interaction with their associates, wherein customer design teams want to make customers' closets a little bit more functional, a little bit more cleaner. They take the specs of a person's said closet in their home and try to give them different options to try to make purchases from the store. But you can see that the redesign features custom closets here with this new concept as a real focal point with some higher ceilings, anchoring the custom closet studio in the store itself. So you actually have design teams that don't have to go into your closet in your home. You can actually try to see it virtually in the store. This, according to the company, allows customers to visualize possibilities at every product level in different price ranges. So again, here they get an opportunity to sort of flaunt their different product selection. It is an elevated and more comfortable experience featuring a new hospitality component as well, including a seating area just adjacent to the custom closet studio where customers can review an inspiring book, according to the company, and gather ideas for their own spaces. They have TVs set up, they have chairs, They have a few tables, according to the pictures that we saw. For analysts, they call this more of a lounge or a break area for customers that just want to relax and maybe take a break because, to be honest, it is exhausting. And this is something that management has talked about in the past. They don't want customers to get overwhelmed when they come into the Container Store stores. They want them to be able to relax, understand that it is going to be a longer-term process to try to get everything that you want aligned and to not be rushed in this process. So some areas of the custom closets look more like a men's warehouse tailoring area where tables are just laid out and you have multiple monitors. Again, they try to exploit the new digital integration that they have here with over 18 different monitors spread throughout the store. And so I think customers, to their point, are going to get overwhelmed at first. When you first come into the store, it is sort of this hybrid setup that integrates technology with these wide aisles, with this well-lit, high-ceiling area. It's going to be a lot for customers that are used to the old store footprint. The kitchen area is a bit fuller with cooking utensils and glassware spread throughout. And lastly, the checkout, like with the main store aisles, is going to be widened a little bit. The layout is strikingly similar to what we have actually seen with a main competitor of theirs, an up-and-coming competitor who is now listed on the stock market as well with At Home. At Home is a retailer that is taking over old Target locations, so they're offering a little bit more square footage than the average Container Store square footage, but they are really not as upscale. And in terms of the counters, again, a lot of similarities with coming to the checkout lane. There's not a lot of upsell items like candy bars and things of that nature, but you do see a lot of similarities with how they line up the cashier tables. And honestly, I think this is going to be a good option for them going forward. It's not going to be as cluttered. Trent mentioned IKEA, where IKEA checkout lanes, you can kind of get lost. It's going to be a little bit easier to get in and get out of their stores. Shares ticker TCS are up nearly 160% since October of last year, currently around $8.40 per share, still way down from just post IPO levels where the shares rocketed past $35 a share in the beginning of 2014. The market cap for the company at their current trading levels is around $400 million.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or potentially year, and we begin with Leighton.
Chipotle was all over the news this week as their new CEO, Brian Niccol, new as in winter of this last year, came in with some bullish statements about the company, but he said it's going to be some trying times in the short term as they're trying different things as far as some snack items, a new food menu, a happy hour, a change in headquarter location, and closing 55 to 65 stores over the next year out of a fleet of around 2,400 stores that they currently operate. So this, obviously, a lot of mixed reaction, but the initial reaction shot the shares down of Chipotle, ticker CMG, around 2 to 3%. To be honest, Trent, they are doing a lot of what they should have already been doing. And we talked about this before recording, but a lot of these snack items, talking about quesadillas, talking about milkshakes, talking about nachos, these are all things that customers have been wanting for quite some time. Not necessarily the milkshake optionality, but these are things that they are trying out, and they're spending more money on trying to reinvent some short-term, limited-time items to try to get customers in during non-peak times. And I think this is genius because if you look at the happy hour times between 2 and 5 p.m., a lot of the locations really don't see a lot of traffic between that time frame. Believe it or not, lunch actually takes place a lot earlier than that for most individuals. And then also trying to extend some limited time items after 8 p.m., which of course Chipotle stores are open till 10 p.m., but you see traffic waning around 7:30 at night. So I think this is interesting in that the company is in fact headed in a different direction with all of the new leadership changes. And I mentioned, Trent, the headquarters, they're moving it to Newport Beach, California. And so combined with the store closures, some restructuring from within the company, it's going to be costing the company around $115 to $135 million. And this is a forecast by Chipotle itself. I think this is interesting because I don't know necessarily what they see in Newport Beach, California, but perhaps their companies have been pushing for this. Perhaps they feel like innovation is going to spur on. Perhaps they can maybe hire some new individuals. They feel maybe like the talent pool is greater in Southern California. Regardless, a ton of different changes at Chipotle are coming very soon. Lastly, Chipotle is going to be launching a customer loyalty program, which again, we've all been calling for, not just the short-term loyalty programs like they had rolled out last summer and the different buy one, get one offerings that they have on a consistent basis. This is going to be rolled out nationally in 2019. They didn't give many details into this, but they want to integrate it with their digital ordering system, which also is going to get yet another makeover. And again, it's not been that long since their new iteration of their mobile ordering platform had just been rolled out. So I think this is going to be very interesting. And I am a loyal Chipotle customer. I'm excited for the changes, particularly with the product changes. I want to try everything new that they have, even if that does not include a chocolate milkshake.
And I think one of the things that we've heard regarding their headquarters is certainly the fact that their new headquarters would be a little bit closer to an area that their CEO is familiar with versus Denver, Colorado. Well, my looking ahead story has to do with Shopko, the general merchandise retailer that has about 220 stores in the United States. They're large format Shopko stores and also smaller format Shopko hometown stores. Apparently sent out a letter that their suppliers were to respond to earlier this week. Shopko vendors had until June 25th to answer to new terms being put down by Shopko onto their vendors. The terms included reducing the total cost of products by 7.5% effective this month. So effective in June already. Hold that lower pricing firm as well for the next 24 months. Shopko also noted in this letter that it wouldn't guarantee any volume outside of current agreements, any additional volume that is, and they forced extended payment terms. Now, vendors that didn't respond to this letter by earlier this week, by June 25th, would by default agree to the terms. But I'm interested to see how many vendors decided not to agree to these terms. 7.5% reduction in cost, that is a big chunk. And in a wholesale distribution system, sometimes that eats up your entire margin. So it's not unthinkable to see some national credit vendors maybe pull their products from Shopko because of these new terms. And this letter, by the way, was acquired by Home Textiles Today, which is a publication that one of the first in the country to actually put this out. And in this letter, it was signed by CMO or Chief Merchandising Officer Ron Oda and Home Vice President Jack Milligan. It said that pricing pressure is intense and all our competitors are moving aggressively to lower their cost structure to attract and retain business. We cannot be an exception. That is a quote from this letter. But again, looking long term, you wonder how many vendors are going to pull their products from Shopko. And also, one thing that's unknown is whether this was just sent out to home supplies vendors or whether it was sent out to all vendors in Shopko. Either way, we've heard rumblings that Shopko may not be in the best position financially. They've got some tough leases that they're combating, some build-to-suit stores that they were struggling with from a real estate perspective. And so you really wonder about the future of Shopko, which is owned by Sun Capital Partners, not a public company. They're owned by a private equity firm. So we don't get an idea as to these finances, but certainly sending out this letter certainly suggests that Shopko is pulling out all the stops to try and salvage any type of margin going forward. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. A big thanks to our interview guests, Justine Santa Cruz and Wendy Albert. Everyone have a great 4th of July holiday or a great Canada Day if you're our neighbors to the north, or just a great first day of July if you're anywhere else in the world. And we'll see you in 7 days.
This has been the Retail Focus podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.